Hi, I'm Sharad Kutan, and welcome to Let's Talk, the show that brings you the most important conversations of the day. Today, we're going to be looking at the reform agenda, the making of Malaysia Baru, what it will take to accomplish this task, but first, what we need to understand about the nature of the state that we live in, Malaysia, and the society that we are, that underpins these aspirations for a new Malaysia. To help me in this conversation, I have Terence Gomez, Professor of Political Economy at University of Malaya, Ross Tapsell, Director of the Malaysia Institute at the Australian National University, and Ben Sufian, Founder and Coordinator at Merdeka Centre. Thank you so much, gentlemen, for being here. Let's begin with you, Terence, and the question of what the Malaysian state. I'm asking you as a political economist, who understands the undergirding of the system, is there something that we can talk, is there something like a Barisan National State? How would you describe this entity that we have that we seem to want to reform at this point in time?
Well, one of the key features of the Barisan National, which we must appreciate, is the extreme concentration of power, both political and economic power, in the hands of the Prime Minister. And that shift in terms of power from different institutions into the hands of the executive happened over a period of about 20 years. So by the time we came to the elections in May 9th last year, the key problem was the way that power concentrated in the office of the Prime Minister was being abused to serve vested interests, which inevitably led also to the serious allegation of kleptocracy. This was one issue that they had to address during the election.
Is that how you see it, Ben? The concentration of power in the hands of the executive, the exclusion of the parliament or other, or civil society or other intervening institutions?
No, I think, you know, society is bisected into maybe many parts. The chattering classes of people who are more critical, who have greater access to political leadership and access to information about how the government deals with policy and the public, I think that group is very much interested in terms of how that power had been concentrated and how it was used, whether for public utility or for personal gain of certain people. And I think from the standpoint of the public, when we look through the surveys that we had in the past, most people here in Malaysia, the majority of which, do not really respond in, I would say, great outrage towards grand corruption. They respond more towards petty corruption when they get stopped for a bribe, by the roadside or at a counter demanding service. People respond more towards that. I think what happened during the May 9th, 2018 election was a confluence of two factors. Number one, yes, within the elites, this great discomfort about how power had been abused. But within the masses is how state resources did not seem to reach them in the amounts that they desired because they were paying taxes. Many people started to pay sales tax for the first time, and suddenly you opened up a whole swath of the population to become taxpayers and therefore demanding representation.
Right, okay. Before we get to what actually happened on May 9th, because that obviously is going to shape the way in which we think politicians should respond or are responding, the question of what is the Malaysian state? Ross, you're an Indonesianist, but you also now lead the Malaysia Institute. Are you having thoughts, especially in a kind of comparative framework?
Sure. Well, comparative political scientists would talk about Malaysia being an electoral authoritarian regime under the Barisan Nasional. And so when we think about what is elections under an electoral authoritarian regime, that's that they're free and that people have a free vote, but they're not fair. And I think that's one thing to think about in this reform period. How do you make elections more fair? Fair in terms of equal media access to all parties and candidates, fair in terms of the actual voting system of gerrymandering, malapportionment. And that's some of the big challenges, I think, going from the old regime to the ideally new regime.
Right, so there are a lot of terms that social scientists use, a soft authoritarian, so on and so forth.
Semi-democracy.
Pseudo-democracy that's been used before. Terence, the question of race, since there are many Malaysians who have the view, and critical and jaundiced, in parts, that the state is dedicated to the Bumiputra. So basically, this is a Bumiputra-orientated state. Now, is that description, or it's in fact a majoritarian state with the interests of the Malay majority at its center, is that a characterization that helped us understand what was in the past and what needs to be done in the future?
Well, I'd like to build on what Ross has just said. while we talk about an electoral authoritarian state, one of the key features of the Malaysian state was the presence of what we call the single dominant party state. Now, that's also an important phenomenon of an electoral authoritarian state. Now, in the single authoritarian, when we talk about a single dominant party state, the important point here is that they were not referring to Barisan Nasional. They were not talking about the coalition. They were talking about UMNO. And the problem with UMNO is that UMNO is a race-based party. And the second issue emerging from that, UMNO being a race-based party, is UMNO has also advocated race-based policies. And the reason why UMNO has advocated race-based policies is because if you look at electoral trends over the past few elections, the real contest during elections was in what we call the Malay heartland states.
But is it fair to say, to discount the coalition? Because coalition, in many ways, lent legitimacy, didn't it, to the stability of UMNO rule, if you like to say that UMNO was central to that?
Well, that's a good point, because when we look at the Barisan Nasional, here our discussion is focusing on the peninsula. But let's not forget PBB. PBB
from
in Sarawak. Now, that was an important state. And if you take UMNO and PBB together, that's an interesting combination which allows them to remain in power. But here's the other interesting thing. PBB is also recognized as a single dominant party state in Sarawak, long-standing party there too. So when we talk about the Barisan Nasional Coalition, if you're talking about the peninsula, yes, we're talking about UMNO. But when we talk about the country as a whole, we also have to factor in now PBB. Why? Because basically UMNO had lost the support in other parts of the peninsula. The Pakatan had managed to acquire a lot of support among, and this is an important point building on what Ben said, the rise of the new middle class.
Ben, very quickly, your take on the question of ethnicity or race or identity when it comes to the Malaysian state?
Well, I think, you know, I hate to say this, that when we look at the data coming up from elections, whether the polls we do or the analysis we perform, we find that the ethnicity of the respondent, the ethnicity of the voter, is one of the most important variables that explain how people vote. There are certainly other factors at play, whether people live in an urban or rural area, how connected they are to information, that influences people in a big way. But what we notice is that there are certain values that underpin voters, that motivates them in making choices. What we do notice is that it's hard to separate the ethnic element away from the choices they make. If we look at 2018, the outcomes for that, it's very clear that the majority of the Malay voters voted for parties other than Barisan Nasional. But more of them went to Malay-based party like PAS as opposed to Pakatan. But there are differences. So we've noticed that there are regional differences, there are generational differences. But underpinning all this, the ethnic variable is still fairly strong in explaining how people behave.
And so they do see the state in ethnic terms as a protector of, you know, of the rights of the Malays, for instance. That would actually be a positive, not a negative, in their view.
It is. I mean, people see the state as, in a sense, their guardian, you know, a place for them to turn to in order to obtain economic resources, benefits, you know, favors and things like that. I recall, you know, years ago, we did a simple survey that asked, you know, whether people had received government funding, worked with the government, obtained jobs from government contracts, in order to try and understand how big was the patronage network. I think we had a figure of somewhere around 40 to 45% of the Malay population, you know, who had a family member that was part of the patronage network or directly employed by the government. So you have a great dependency on government, and that I think typifies the UMNO state before 2018.
Okay, and so we'll come back to those issues of patronage as well as paternalism. Stay tuned to Let's Talk. Welcome back to Let's Talk. I'm Sharad Kutin. With me, Terence Gomez, Ross Tapsell, and Ben Sofiat, all here to help me understand the nature of the Malaysian state, of Malaysian society, and also our aspirations for reform. Let's come back to the question of corruption and paternalism as well as corruption patronage. Terence, I know you've written a lot about this. Tell us, is patronage something that is central to the Malaysian state, as Ben suggested? And if so, is it something that needs to be dismantled if we're moving forward?
With long-term implementation of the new economic policy, which went on to have different names, we call it now affirmative action or the Bumiputra policy, patronage has come to be embedded within the political system. The point here is this: when that policy, the new economic policy, was introduced, it was targeted at helping the poor to redistribute wealth more equitably. And they created institutions to implement mechanisms to channel concessions to the poor to lift them out of poverty. When you have a hegemonic state, a single dominant party state, and they have been in power for a long time, the concern we had was that this dominant party began to hijack those resources meant for the poor to enrich themselves. And that's what happened in the case of UMNO, which is why UMNO began to be seen as a get-rich-quick party, and which ultimately led also to corruption, and eventually even to notions such as rent-seeking, and finally we got the problem of kleptocracy.
So it's possible to continue that, just get rid of the abuses, but remain, that mechanism of redistribution could continue. Was that the conclusion that you
come to? Well, we've got to go back to the policy itself. You know, the policy has got some good elements to it. The fact of the matter is we still have a bottom 40%. Now, when you think about it, bottom 40%, that's about, what, 12 million people? 12 million people in need of help. So we do need a policy that targets helping that bottom 40%. The question, of course, is should it be race-based? I'm opposed to race-based policies. I prefer a class-based perspective. Target the bottom 40%. That's one dimension. The second dimension is the institutional mechanisms to reach that targeted group. Do we have a system in place, checks and balances, to ensure it reaches them, or as they like to say, it reaches only the creamy layer, the people who don't really need it? That's the reform we're looking for.
Right. Okay, so this is interesting, because it seems like, you know, you could all be on board with a reform agenda that targets the needy, so on and so forth. But there's an effective dimension to all this, right? People feel that they're entitled, and something that perhaps is part of a cultural dimension of things, that somehow, by being Bumiputra, you are entitled these. So even if you are not in need necessarily, you're still entitled. Does that play a part at all, Ben, do you think, in the way people calculate their political decisions? If they see a party that says, well, we want to just be fair to everybody, would that be sufficient for them to be attractive to a particular segment of voters?
I think it's a popular notion that people have a sense of entitlement. To some extent, there is some truth to that. And it's not simply because of the patronage system that came about in the wake of the NEP. I think it's also embedded in the feudal Malay culture, you know. So it's part and parcel of society here that you look up to your elder person to look after you, your village chief looks after you, so on and so forth. But I think that notion is changing as well. I would say over the last maybe decade or two decades, there are more and more Bumiputras that are trying to seek out and make a living for themselves. So there is an emerging, I would say, quote-unquote, authentic Bumiputra entrepreneurial circle that is less dependent on government. I think that group is still relatively small, but there is a nascent entrepreneurial class that's emerging that is less dependent on government help. But one can't help, you know, step away from the fact that the rest of the community is enmeshed in patronage networks, that you need to know someone powerful in order for you to get a favor. I think the recent developments that we see in social media about getting product endorsements from cabinet ministers and so on, you know, reflects that mentality that still pervades. And it's a two-way street. People in power also want to be seen helping those who need help because it seems that they are providing the community a service. And people down there also expect to be helped. So it's a culture that needs to evolve. But what's, I think, missing is a system of ethics to understand what is right and wrong, what is permissible for a political leader to behave and not.
What do you? What's your take of, you know, Ross, kind of viewing the last, what, 9 months it's been since the general elections, the fact that corruption has become a major theme for the new government, but they seem to be very wary about pushing other agendas.
Well, I would spend a lot of time in Kedah and Langkawi during the election campaign, and I tried to hang out in rural or semi-rural areas just to get a sort of more anthropological sense of what voters were thinking in the lead up to May 9. I sort of have a different take on the corruption to what you were saying earlier, Ben, in that a lot of the messages that came out, particularly from the opposition, was that for rural people, they don't really care about 1MDB and it's too confusing and they don't really understand everything. And actually, at the local level, it's much more about, you know, are they getting bribed unfairly or do they have to give bribes and so on. But from my experience in these areas, a lot of people did talk about 1MDB in that they were very quick to say, well, Najib is corrupt. And when I ask, well, how did you know about this? How did you find that information? Often the answers were, well, Facebook or WhatsApp. Yeah. And so that, I think, is the transformation that's occurred in 2018 from 2013. The information societies, in particularly semi-rural Malay areas, has changed a lot. And so I think people are aware of those big corruption issues, but they relate it more at their local level. And Mahathir then came in and said, you know, you take the money for the on election day, you know, but it's only a tiny percentage of what the state has reaped from you, and they owe you a lot more. Worked perfectly.
Yeah, I mean, I found the same situation. We were up in the boonies in Baram in Sarawak, in a longhouse area where there's no regular supply of electricity, and we had a town hall meeting with the villagers there, and the same issue that came up was 1MDB, but how they related to their daily lives was, they had to pay GST, so whenever they bought this prepaid, prepaid charges for their phone, they had to pay 60 cents GST, and they were complaining about that. And they say, this money that we are paying as a tax to the government is going to bail out 1MDB. I mean, they can relate the two things together, but in our analysis, it was most people live in hardship. I mean, if you look at people in this country, we escape our Klang Valley bubble. Most people live in relative hardship in Malaysia, and so most people are just scraping by, you know. And when we go out there, the issue of taxes and the economy really, I think, plays a big impact on them. And when they see government leaders living outside of their normal means, I think they get angry. And I think that's what was the vein that was tapped on election.
Okay, so we'll come back to the question of the anger that animated the general election on May 9th and what it means for how this government, the newly minted, plays out their role in the reform agenda. Stay tuned. Hi, welcome back to Let's Talk. I'm Sharad Pitton. With me, Terence Gomez, Professor of Political Economy at University of Malaya, Ross Tapsell, Director of the Malaysia Institute at the Australian National University, and Ben Sofian with Merdeka Centre. Now, we ended up with a discussion about the anger that was on the ground, people related or didn't relate, as it may be, to the issues of 1MDB to their daily lives. Terence, the question that's often out there, kind of implicit, is that some people seem to think that on May 9th, Malaysians voted in for a complete transformation of state and society, you know, with all kinds of agendas, cultural, social, political, whatever. And others think actually was quite much more limited, what exactly voters wanted. I mean, how do you see it?
Well, during the campaign period, I had a team and we visited every state in the peninsula. And the issue that struck me was this, the level of dysfunctionality in the Pakatan Rakyat. The Pakatan Harapan. The Pakatan Harapan was a coming together of rather strange bedfellows. Bersatu was basically a faction from UMNO. PKR had its own problems. They were a deeply divided party going into the election. The one party that looked fairly united was the DAP. And Amana, being a new party, very much in its infancy stage, lacked the missionary to really go down to the ground and do the work. And Amana had not made any inroads, I would argue, in the Malay heartland states, in Kelantan, Terengganu, Kedah. So the Pakatan Harapan came across to me as a party that was very weak in the states that really mattered. That's the Malay heartland states. And of course, they had very little currency in the Borneo states. So how then do we explain the sudden shift? We could see on the missionary on the ground was weak. The only states where they were doing well were in the more industrialized states, and that I would argue also because there was already a new urban middle class ready for change, and they'd been articulating for change for quite some time now. So the issues I would think which came up to the fore from my own visits to the ground was one core issue was the GST. The GST, the tax burden, and I agree with Ben's point, the difficulties, the hardships that people faced. The second issue which definitely came up was corruption. And it was very easy to capture the corruption that was so blatant in the Barisan Nasional because it dealt with three core institutions, FELDA, for example, MARA, and Tabung Haji. The thing about these three institutions were these were institutions which were Bumiputra-based institutions. These were institutions targeting the poor in particular. And FELDA was a key constituency too, and they lost FELDA. FELDA has got great presence in a number of constituencies which they need to win, and they have always won in previous elections. They lost that too. So the swing against the Barisan Nasional because of great discontent with its form of governance, I would argue, was the reason why Barisan lost.
Okay, so let's maybe agree that there are many factors that led to the losses, depending on where you are and so on and so forth. What is its implication for the government of the day, though? I mean, should it now say, well, we won, whatever the reason we won, maybe we just were very lucky, but now is the time to push a reform agenda, perhaps greater than that expected of our voters. What do you think, Ben?
Well, I think, you know, they won because people wanted a new type of leadership that addressed the issues faced by the voters. The issue of corruption and mismanagement was the fault of the previous administration. The new government comes in with a strong anti-corruption agenda, and the polls that we have done has reflected that. People appreciate the view that the government has taken on corruption. We've noted that, you know, public appreciation of the anti-corruption agency has significantly improved over the last 9 months. All of that is there. Independence of the courts, so trust in courts have also improved over the last time. So trust in institutions have all improved. Even trust in democracy has improved. The one significant area where things have not improved and in fact has gotten worse is trust in the government's ability to address economic issues. And then, you know, then we go to this bottom 40%. And then the issue of, is it really 40%? We would argue that nearly two-thirds of the population of this country, you know, encounter some economic hardship. And I think for this government to move ahead, it needs to articulate a plan in terms of how it's going to address that problem. It needs a broad-based plan, but it also has a plan that ordinary people can discuss and speak among themselves. And that, I think, has to happen soon, because otherwise the window will start to close and the critics will be louder than the people who are optimistic.
Ross, so very quickly, what do you think observers are doing? Are they focused on the right things? Are they just looking at ICERD and the anti-ICERD debacle and so on and so forth, the human rights issues, and not looking at the bread and butter issues that Ben says actually animates the ground?
Good question. I mean, I don't know. I think to answer your first question, now is the time for a reform agenda, and the reform agenda needs to be led by the progressives and by, and they will be criticised for being part of the Klang Valley and for not taking into account bread and butter economic issues. And that is probably an inevitable part of the reform process. But I think there are a lot of people wanting to make big reforms, particularly around parliamentary reforms and electoral reforms and so on at the moment. And it's not going to be easy, particularly as Terence said, when we're talking about a Pakatan Harapan government that is, let's say, at times looking like it's involved in factional warfare and not focusing on key reform agendas.
Yeah, I mean, Terence, very quickly, if there is ideological incoherence, you know, like the strange bedfellows, as it were, if you say Pakatan Harapan is, then how do they have a reform agenda that's coherent?
Well, one of the first things that Mahathir did was to set up a council of eminent people. I thought it was a good idea, because the big issue here is about the economy too, and to get the economy back on track. Now we have, of course, the problem of the bottom 40%. We also had this issue which is commonly known as the high middle income trap, and the middle class was also feeling that they were not able to move up. So there are a lot of issues in terms of structural changes that are required within the economy, and that's where the CEP came in. We have a body of people who are eminent economists and business people who understand the economy, who understand the corporate sector, who understand the need to bring about reforms. They were supposed to meet the relevant people and come out with their reforms.
But what we do know is that the institutional reform document has not been released. And that's something that we'll come back to tomorrow when we continue this conversation. I've been speaking to Terence Gomez, Professor of Political Economy at University of Malaya, Ben Sufian with Merdeka Center, and Ross Tapsell with the Malaysia Institute at the Australian National University. Join us tomorrow when we continue our look at the reform agenda. This is Let's Talk with Mishra Adkutin, only on Astro 1E.